Blog Talk Radio.
Playing Sports City Chefs from Amazon Music.
Yeah.
Back, listen, enjoy the vibe. Sip something, light it up, enjoy the ride. Cause the Sports City Chefs is on the night. In the kitchen cooking up, they on the rise.
Sports City Chefs, Chefs. Sports City, Sports City Chefs, Chefs. Sports City, Sports City Chefs, Chefs. Sports City, Sports City Chefs,
Yes, Lord, we got a brand new present. What? Joe Biden, we riding, I pray you heaven sent. Word from the wise, my people stay ahead of me.
Come on,
I've been relevant, trying to survive the elements. It ain't no love in these streets, these dudes telling it. Case go from cold to hot, state evidence. Kaboom, Sports City Chefs is in the room. Cooking up hot topics to put up on your spoon. They well in tune, blown like a flower in June. Superman vs. MF Doom, the clouds loom. So tell a friend, it's the Sports City Chefs again. Pay attention, tune in, we on the set again.
Sports City, Chef, Chef. Sports City, Chef, Chef. Yeah. Cabby. Taj.
Woo! Connecticut.
All right, here we go. First show. Here we have Dave on with Nate. How you doing, Nate?
I'm doing just fine, Dave. How are we holding up?
Boy, there's been so much going on with the last week of baseball kicking off the season. Let's just take a quick look around the league at what happened earlier in the day. We had the Cardinals beating the Brewers 3-1. The Twins winning 10-2 over the Mariners. Twins now 5-2 on the year. Cardinals, by the way, are also 5-2. Rockies went ahead 7-3 to pull away from the Diamondbacks. And the Red Sox, unfortunately, beat your Orioles to fall to go up to 4-3, and the Orioles fall to 4-3. We have the Cubs punching the Pirates in the face, going 4-2. And the most interesting ending of the day, and as the year plays out, what could very well be one of the most interesting finishes of the year, are the Mets winning in a walk-off hit-by-pitch against the Marlins. The thing is, the hit-by-pitch was also a strike. And despite being called a third strike, the umpire immediately signaled that it was a hit-by-pitch, sending in the run as that hit by pitch was done with the bases loaded. And that is how the Marlins lost. Nate, did you have a chance to see the end of that game?
I did. And I think Michael Conforto has earned himself a lot more, let's call them obvious hit by pitches in the next couple of games as he moves, works his way through the season for how he decided to cheaply earn that RBI.
Now, here's the thing. We've seen tactics, antics like that in the past. I know one of the frequent ones that I think of is A-Rod slapping the glove when he was rounding third. You know, it's not unprecedented to hear of a player saying, you know, I got it or I'm coming, you know, when a pop fly is coming down to an infielder. How do you feel about things like the unwritten rules in a case like this? Like if a player acts like they got hit by a pitch to try to get the free base or get at a runner, especially in a spot here where it's the game on the line. I mean, you know, there's a sense of competitiveness in me that comes out and says, hey, look, you know, you might not like what he did, and it sounds like you sure don't, and I think you expect a lot of the players not to like what happened. But as a, you know, if I was a fan of the Mets, and I know at the end of the season, you know, that NL East is going to be tight. Now, I would say the separation for a game is huge. And if it takes a little leaning into the pitch, why not?
Yeah, well, first I want to want to just draw a little bit of a delineation here. I don't know that this was so much him acting like he got hit by a pitch, but he legitimately got hit. If you watch the replay back and if you watch it in slow motion, like, it did go off his elbow. This isn't, you know, Derek Jeter taking the ball on the knob of the bat and saying, oh, I got hit. No, that ball hit your bat. That ball's in play. You're not taking the base there. Not to make a callback to anything that sits in my crawl or anything like that. Anyway, you know, he leaned into it. He definitely, like, he put his arm into the strike zone to get hit. Now, I actually do kind of agree with you. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. You know, it's tactics, competitive advantage. Is it against the unwritten rules? I mean, we can go around and around in the unwritten rules and how I think, you know, some of them I think are crap. And, you know, the players that get all up in arms about them, you just kind of sit there and you're like, okay, go have a seat. Nobody cares. This one, again, it's the competitive edge. I think it's fine. He has to know that he didn't make many friends on the other side there, because it's a little bush league in a sense. Like, it's that 5-year-old that goes up playing little league and knows he's not going to get a hit. So he's just leaning into it. Or to make a callback to an old TV show, Coach from Cheers, who led the league in hit by pitches because he managed to get hit no matter where the ball was thrown. Like, he went up there with a plan. He accomplished it, saw the opening and took it. And, you know, he's just going to have to wear it the next time a pitcher decides to retaliate.
Why not, though? If the pitcher retaliates, you know generally in retaliation that they don't really retaliate in a big spot like the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded. That's not the spot to do it. So if it takes getting hit in maybe the first plate appearance the next time they see each other, or, third inning in a runaway game that's already 7-0, and you get plunked in the hip, you know, I would assume, by the way, that no pitcher would headhunt, and I like to think that doesn't happen, and any time it happens, it's a mistake. So let's just say, for argument's sake, it is going to be a retaliation. It's in the hip. You know, isn't that worth it? I don't know. I would say, why the heck not? You know what? If you're just going to beam me in the hip, but I got ourselves a win – that, like, that NL East, I keep going back to it, and I will continue to keep going back to it. You know, as a Jets fan, I remember hearing you play to win the game on repeat for, you know, I still hear it to this day, and that's my attitude. Like, I understand why it's Bush League, and I don't disagree. It is not really in the spirit of the game. Really, the spirit of the game, ideally, would be in that spot to take a ball. Well, it actually was a called strike. So, yeah, I mean, what else would you do? You can't just sit there and look at it, and he clearly didn't decide to swing. So, you know, what's the other outcome? When there's a pitch thrown, it's either going to be a foul ball. In that case, it was going to be a third strike out. I don't hate what he did.
Yeah, and, you know, the more you think on it, actually, like, how many times have you been watching a game and, you know, your team just needs base runners, like, and you have, like, the team has not been hitting, a guy's up there, and a pitcher loses control of the ball, like, he yanks a breaking ball deep inside, like, way inside the, and the batter, he jumps out of the way. Like, how many times have you been watching the game, you're just like, dude, stand in there, let it hit you, we need the runner.
So you grew up
a little
different here. But, no, I know you grew up an Orioles fan, and this is something I feel like it never got enough attention, was Derek Jeter. I mean, he was the guy you always wanted up, you know, for me at least, wanted always to see in a big spot. And I would assume for you, if you're, you know, rooting for the Orioles and it's the bottom of the ninth, Jeter's up. And I think generally playing, he was considered a stand-up guy, but he would always kind of, if there was a curveball and it was low, not necessarily too low, but, you know, I'd say hips level, he would start to sink down as the ball neared the plate. And I always thought that was interesting. It seemed like he was purposefully trying to change the eye level of the ump or change the eye level of the ball. So I feel like it's not dissimilar, but every time I saw him do that, it seemed like he would get the benefit of the doubt. And you're always going to want that, right? If you know, you watch any, and this happens in any sport, you know, especially in basketball or soccer, where I know one of the prevailing kind of knocks on soccer is if somebody gets hit, even lightly, they roll around on the ground. In basketball, just about any time there's a shot, somebody's going to say, well, they hit my arm, even if sometimes if it's not obvious. I mean, there's anti-flopping rules. Whereas in baseball, I think baseball is held to a little bit of a higher standard amongst the players. So, you know, that kind of brings me back to that, how are they going to retaliate? If you, let me ask you, though, if this happened to a player on your team, if this was for a critical win for the Orioles to get a good season going, like let's say this happened now, wouldn't you want a player on your team to kind of do everything they could to win? I mean, how would you feel if this was your team?
Yeah, you know, I can say that I watch games, and there's times where things happen where my reaction is, okay, I like that result, but I'm really not happy with how we got there kind of thing. You know, it's like, and I guess the ends justify the means approach. You'd rather the guy go up there and, you know, beat out a ground ball than lean in over the plate and, you know, catch one on the elbow. But yeah, from a fan perspective, it's at the end of the day, it's all about the W. Go out, get the win, do what you got to do to get the win. I would also expect that the next game out, if it gets out of control or if we're way ahead, like if one team is way ahead and the pitcher throws way inside and plunks the guy in the hip, I don't want to see that guy then turn around and charge the mound like a hothead. You basically then should turn, like you should go back to the pitcher, acknowledge like, yeah, I get it. Okay, I'm wearing it now. I'm taking my base, and, you know, that's the end of it. Don't let it go any further.
So, hold on. This made me think of something. I've been meaning to ask you this since this whole show is conceptualized. Roughneck Odor, new Yankee, was not happy with the Jose Bautista bat flip. Just want to take a quick trip in time. I loved Jose Bautista's bat flip. It was one of my favorite things. I played that on a loop for about a week. I thought it was great. I thought it was really ridiculous that Roughneck Odor took exception to it. I believe, you know, it's, again, I like to link and put my frame of baseball mind into other sports. It reminds me, I believe it was Cam Newton who once said, you know, if you're tired of us running up the score, just stop us. And that's how I felt. Like, if you're going to be upset about a guy flipping the bat, well, don't let him hit the ball out.
Yeah, but you know, I love Roughneck Odor's right hook. Like
that was a good punch.
That's an iconic image of baseball. I think the only baseball punch that I like more than that is Nolan Ryan putting Robin Ventura in a headlock and just going to town on him.
But
yeah,
you know,
I get what you're saying, and I agree with that take. Like, hey, if you don't want me doing it, don't let me hit the home run. But I think there's also like a fine line, and you know, to borrow from the Supreme Court justice, though, I'm going to screw this up, try to go off the top of my head, but we're going to call it Justice Black, where he's, you know, the classic line where he's trying to define what is pornography, and his answer is, well, I know it when I see it. Like, that's kind of the line of when is this action acceptable and when have you crossed the line kind of thing. Like, I'm all for guys going out there having fun flipping bats. Sometimes it's a lot of fun, and then other times it's like, okay, you know, start by.
Now, wait, I have a little bit of an issue with this take. So you're saying sometimes it's okay to flip a bat, sometimes it's not?
I'm generally okay with the bat flip. I think there are times where you can take it a little too far. Like,
okay, that's...
And I guess it's kind of hard to define where that line would be, but, you know, if I'm going to come up with a situation, let's throw it back again to another historic game. The Rangers beat the Orioles 30-3 a long time ago, like one of the worst beatdowns in baseball history. Had one of the Rangers hitters when the game was 27-3, had they gone up and, you know, hit another three-run home run to get those 30th runs across, and he's clipping the bat there.
Right.
That's going to be one where I'm going to be like, okay, dude, like, just let's go, move it along. But, like, you know, the the walk-off win, but, like the walk-off grand slam, flip that bat.
Now, counter thought, right? See, this is what I think the great players and the great teams and what you need to do to be a professional. I am on the other side of you on this one with the 30-3 game. If you're incredibly competitive, and this is something I don't know if I would have thought of until I saw the Jordan documentary that came out almost, you know, so it was last June, I believe. And he and a lot of other, you know, greatest athletes, Muhammad Ali too, you know, they always try to find micro challenges, it seems like, or they almost invent mindsets to try to overcome. So if you're in a game, it's 27-3, you know, the best way to not get mentally checked out, the best way to stay in your rhythm, and this is assuming the manager kept you in and didn't take you out, which would happen today, and back then I would assume it didn't, because I don't exactly remember the date of that, but I'm going to go ahead and say it was before, you know, 2010, when analytics really just took way off, maybe even earlier than that was going back to Moneyball. But you know, if you're down, you know, 3-27, and you see some guy celebrating hitting a 3-run home run to get to 30, of course that's going to, you know, be really upsetting. But if you're the guy who's hitting the home run, what if somewhere around 26 runs, you're thinking to yourself, like, oh, my gosh, we could get to 30. You know, that's a whole other achievement. And then at that point, you know, if you're the manager, you try to say, all right, guys, let's stay fresh, let's stay good, let's try to just keep, you know, every time you get up there, you want to get a hit. I think you'd be insane not to. What are you going to do? Why not just bunt ourselves till the game is over? You're going to keep fighting. And, you know, I would say make that 30-run mark a thing to hit. Try to go for it. That's my attitude on that, you know.
Yeah, and I don't want to get twisted. I don't really think that – I'm not opposed to running up the score in baseball for exactly like you said. Like, hey, this is baseball. The famous Earl Weaver quote, we can't just run the ball into the lineman three times and then run the clock out. Like, you got to get 27
right.
outs. And if the other team can't get you out 27 times, keep scoring, man. Like, keep the runs coming across the plate. I think the difference, though, is – you know, if you're the guy that's hitting that ball, is it really necessary to show up the other pitcher or show up the other team further than the fact that you've hunked 30 on them in a baseball game?
So I want to take that exact thought, that mindset you have right now, and bring it back to Conforto. So
yes.
if you specifically are Conforto, first, walk me through that last pitch. Are you leaning into it? And if you do lean into it, which you better say yes. Otherwise, then you're just saying, oh, well, I don't care about winning the game. I just want to, you know, have all the integrity in the world. Let's just say you do lean into the pitch. What do you do that next press conference when they ask you about it? Do you say you did it? Do you say, oh, you know, I don't know? Or how would you, you know, how would you want to see that handled?
I would love to see Conforto just come out and be like, yeah, I leaned into it and he hit me. Like, I was trying to win the game. I kind of have this view on things generally. Like, look, I can see what you did. Don't lie to me and tell me it was something different, because now you're basically telling me I'm an idiot. Don't do that. Like, just be honest with me. Like, I'm upset at you enough for – you know, breaking the unwritten rule. Don't turn around and then try and tell me, like, oh, no, it was inside. It actually hit me. I wasn't out over the place. Like, yeah, you were, man. Come on.
Well, I mean, at some point, you just have to lie in some of those places, because if you do say you did something dishonest, then what's to – because that was the last pitch of the game, what is to stop, say, the commissioner from overruling it, saying, oh, listen, this guy admitted it. You know, I think you set a very unfortunate precedent, but boy, would it be awesome to see a guy come out and just say, oh, yeah, no, I did it. Or, no, that's Pine Tar, my bad. Or, you know, Trevor Bauer comes out tomorrow and says, you got me.
Or Garrett Cole.
Hey, no.
Hey, I'm not the one that sent the text messages to the other team's managers.
That's true. That's true. So, I don't know. I thought that was a very interesting way to finish a game. And I just pulled this up here you know, the rule states that if the ball is in the strike zone when it touches the batter, or the batter makes no attempt to avoid being touched by the ball, so I'm sorry, states a batter is entitled to first base when he's hit by a pitch unless, so these are the exceptions to being entitled to first base, if the ball's in the strike zone when it touches the batter, or the batter makes no attempt to avoid being touched by the ball. You know, that's the key part. And then it says if the ball is in the strike zone when it touches the batter, it's a strike, whether or not the batter tries to avoid the ball. And if the ball is outside the strike zone when it touches the batter, it's a ball, if he makes no attempt to avoid being touched. And he made no attempt to avoid being touched. I mean, that much is clear.
No, he tried to get touched.
Yeah, it was gaslighting, quite frankly.
So this is actually kind of interesting because the exact opposite thing happened in the Orioles-Red Sox game today. Rio Ruiz was at the plate, and he got hit in the back foot, I believe. But in the process of him like getting out of the way, he kind of did like the check swing, half swing. You know, you see it all the time. The guys are like, you know,
right.
You feel like you got to protect yourself, and then you realize, oh crap, it's going to hit me. So you pull the bat back real quick, and then they get hit. Well, that happened, and then the third base umpire ruled it a swing, and Rio Ruiz had to stand in for the rest of the at bat and ended up striking out.
Yeah, you know, I think it's quite an interesting outcome. I mean, in each case, it didn't the pitch didn't go completely right. I always think there's always more blame on the ump than there should be. But I just want to let you know, Nate, I don't know if you saw this, that the umpire after the Conforto play did come out and acknowledge he made the wrong call, saying, quote, that guy was hit by the pitch in the strike zone. I should have called him out.
Ah, so he pulled the Jim Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Jim. Listen, Andres Galarraga, I still say they should go back and give him the perfect game, even though it would mean nothing to anybody. It just really grinds my gears that still sits with a bad taste in my mouth. But, you know,
yeah,
that's what we were just talking about, is people taking accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, power to the umpire for admitting that he missed it. I mean, that's certainly something you wouldn't see Angel Hernandez coming out and saying.
Oh, gosh, no. But and the worst part is, now I almost want, and this is just, the world doesn't work this way, but I almost want the league to say, you know, we'll slap you on the wrist or something like that. You admitted it, it happened, and let's move on. But I'm just, you brought up Angel Hernandez, and that's a situation, where it ended up being more than just somebody saying something in a press conference. That ended up, you know, becoming a legal case of sorts.
That he lost.
Yeah. Do you want to just quickly fill me in on the top line of the case?
So he was claiming that he was being racially discriminated against because he wasn't getting selected for playoff series and the World Series, which, you know, if you're an umpire, it's no different than being a player. You want to ump the biggest, most important games, and Angel Hernandez kept getting passed over. He was claiming it was because of his race. They took it to court, and the judge basically just laughed him right out of court, said, yeah, no, you haven't. Like, on its face, Major League Baseball can show multiple reasons why you were not selected for these. Most, like, top line being, you're a terrible umpire. And to spin that back, I don't know if you saw this or not. He umped the game, I want to say he was the home plate ump, April 6th in the Angels-Astros game. And he was on record as the worst umpired game to date. Granted, it's a young season, but There's a Twitter account out there that tracks, you know, how accurate are these umpires? Because, you know, there's that whole debate, like, when are we getting robo-umps for balls and strike calls, which I'm not necessarily in favor of. But if there's a poster child for why they're needed, it's Angel Hernandez. Because these umpires, like, generally your league average are sitting around, like, 94% accuracy on balls and strikes, on non-swinging balls and strikes. Angel Hernandez was 83%.
You know,
like he was awful.
You brought up an interesting question that I didn't really plan on diving into, but I am curious. You said you're not generally in favor of robot umps, as I like to refer to them. I'm largely in favor of this, and this might be, you know, my data analyst hat, where everything needs to fit very nicely into a box or cell. Either it's a strike or it's not. And I, you know, understand that sometimes, you know, the pitcher might get a wider strike zone, but I mean, either it is or it isn't. There's really no in between. And I always view it from the perspective of the batter, where if you now know exactly what you're looking for each time at the plate, I do think it's going to be a little bit, I shouldn't say a little bit, it will be significantly more advantageous for the batters because they can just sit dead red on certain pitchers, learn locations. I think you're really going to start to see teams putting things like augmented reality or virtual reality as part of the training process, learn to visualize, you know, where the ball leaves the pitcher's hand. But my, you know, the bottom line is I think for consistency's sake, and to, in a way, almost make the baseball cards more accurate, get a true gauge of a player's average. Once you get robot umpires, any of that, you know, excessive strike zones that get people get really upset towards the end of games if it gets tightened up, I'm all for it just for the simple fact of consistency. What's your opposition to it?
So I get the argument for it. I understand, you know, I want a strike to be a strike. I want a ball to be a ball. But, you know, we spent all that time at the top of the show talking about guys like Derek Jeter who could buy themselves an extra ball by doing their role, by doing the squat. You get the guys like, well, like the Conforto situation. If it's a robot, he's out. Yeah. But I guess my take on it is that I still – it's going to be the old curmudgeon approach of this is how the game is supposed to be played. You know, the classic rules, the human element, although I'm not going to go all the way down there because for me, what's more important from an umpire's perspective, I don't care so much about, you know, to the centimeter strike zone. Yes, this is a strike. No, this is a, no, that's a ball. As long as it's called the same throughout the game. So, like, if the umpire is going to give that ball, it's impossible, but they've shown, you know, with the guys that are tracking them, they're still really, really close, like 94% on a league average with guys being above that mark even, being closer to, like, 96, 97% on getting the balls and strikes correct on the zone. Like, that's – I think that's something to be proud of. And the guys that are doing this at the major league level, they're doing it at – such a rate that they've earned their way to the top of the sport. I don't think that it's quite the problem that we like to make it out to be. We just, you know, we like to highlight the guys like the Angel Hernandezes. And it's, I'm happier when, you know, you get that little strike zone box that they put on the screen for every batter. And that's not accurate at all. Like we think it is, but it's really not. And I have a friend that's an umpire, and he loves to rail against this stuff. But, like, if we're looking at that box as a fan, and the umpire is consistently calling the ball, like, 1 inch outside that box, if he's consistently calling out a strike for both teams and it's that way the entire game, that's fine. And the batters can adjust and know, okay, he's calling that, I got to swing at that, I can't take that. It's the situation that you brought up that annoys me is when that's a strike – through the first 8 innings, and then all of a sudden in a one-run game of the ninth, now it's a ball. That's where I start getting agitated. But I would not be upset if they got rid of that little square in the strike zone because, first of all, it's not a dynamic square. If you could note this next time that in the next Yankee game when Aaron Judge does get back on the field. But that strike zone that they put up there on the screen, it's the same size for Brett Gardner as it is for Aaron Judge. And that's just not accurate at all. But we like to think that that's the zone. The strike zone goes from the letters to the knee. And they don't – it's not dynamic. And we're also getting it from, you know, we're getting it from a higher angle. Usually we're getting it from – we're not getting it from dead center in most cases. You're getting it from slightly off center. So we really like, we're trying to judge a strike zone without actually being down there directly behind the plate to judge high, low, left, right.
So I don't disagree with much of what you said. There are a couple things I take issue with. The first is you said you not 94 to 96% success rate for the umpires is something to be proud of. I think that's, you know, completely disagree with you. I think that's embarrassing. I think anything less than 99.9% is not ideal. Because a lot of this is timing. I mean, if that 0.01% or so happens in the World Series in a big spot, you know, what then? That, you know, if it's correctable, correct it. But I do agree with you. I think the technology isn't quite there. I'm no expert of how exactly they draw those up, but I do think if you go towards some electronic umpire or electronic balls and strikes, they would have to implement something in the jerseys or in the players' outfits or actually have something on both sides of the field that triangulate the play. I mean, if they can do, you know, replay angles where it's almost 3D, they could be able to map a strike zone that is dynamic or each player's is unique. I think you're right. That is absolutely important. And you know, you could even just put sensors, you know, in the plate that shoot up. I still don't understand how in football, for instance, they don't have a chip in the nose of at each end of the football to figure out if it's crossing the goal line or not. I mean, come on, that one's a no-brainer. But
you're
actually hitting on
something that I really wanted to invent. I wanted to invent an LED that lit up as soon as the nose of the football crossed the plane.
You just, you know, like the hockey goal line. Exactly. I like where your head's at.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nate, this all this chatter about the rules does have me wonder something that we were talking about earlier in the week offline, which is, you know, the shift that is happening in baseball of the shift. We're seeing, you know, players really adjust to pull hitters. I feel like I'm not even seeing as many true pull hitters, your Mark Teixeira's, your David Ortiz's. Just, you know, pulling it straight to, you know, that spot between first and second. What do you think about the shift? Do you think it's overused or is it destroying the game in a sense because now you're removing a whole bunch of talent for that way? Or do you think players should really just learn to hit the other way or actually bunt in certain situations?
I shade towards the second option. I mean, it goes back to the idea that we mentioned earlier, you know, hey, if you don't want me doing this, stop me from doing it. Like, I'm not going to shift on you if you hit the ball down the left field line on occasion. I do think that there are some managers that are getting a little too deep into the spreadsheets on the percentages when it comes to employing the shift. For example, I'm watching – I'd have to look at the numbers, but, you know, you watch the Orioles and Cedric Mullins, their leadoff guy, he gave up switch hitting this year, so now he's just batting left-handed. And every time he comes to the plate, you know, they put the full shift on around him. But Cedric Mullins can bunt, and he bunts, incredibly well. So that's one that I don't understand. Like, you know, a guy like Cedric Mullins is going to be late. Going to be able to lay down a bunt and you're still willing to put on the shift and rely on Rafael Devers to come in and field that bunt, good luck.
Does it work?
You deserve what you get on that one. What?
But the question is, does it work?
The shift, yeah. I mean, it has
been
working.
So then why keep shifting against them or bring the third baseman in that case?
Well, I mean, the shift is getting out. You know, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it. And I'd say that as I'm watching this A's-Astros game and they literally have the full-scale shift on. And I think that one of the things that hasn't quite caught up, like they're basically, these managers are going off of, hey, this guy hits the ball to right field 70% of the time, so let's put all of our infield over on that side and we'll leave one guy to cover the left side in the off chance that he does shoot one that way. But then the times that you see the hitters beat the shift is more often because the pitchers aren't pitching to the shift. So I think there's a little bit of a disconnect on that one. But I don't have a problem with it. I think if the managers see something and it's going to get out, you know, quickest way to end a ball game is get 27 outs. Do whatever you need to do to get those 27 outs as fast as possible. And if you don't want me shifting on you, hit it the other way. Now, that's also incredibly hard to do, but...
But now, are you... How do you feel about the change in the game that is really leading teams to have, you know, strong power hitters as opposed to a lot of contact? And I know maybe because I see the Yankees all the time try to win, you know, try to slug their way through a game and try to win them all, you know, 5-2 with, you know, a 2-run home run and a 3-run home run. I almost feel like in some ways that's part of what brought the shift on. And what I mean by that is, you know, you've taken the power hitters, and a lot of the power hitters were those pull hitters. I mean, the two I mentioned, Teixeira and Ortiz, you know, were certainly a pair that I saw a lot when I was younger. They would always, you know, either hit a home run to right field, or they would send it right to the guy between first and second. So I think the counter to that was launch angle, and that's a phrase that we've been hearing about a lot more. But it came along around the same time as exit velo, which I personally love that stat. It's completely, I you know, a couple of years ago I would have said it's completely useless, but the more I see it, the more I buy into it. But anyway, you're seeing those players that would ground those balls between first and second now just pop everything up. It's ridiculous. It's leading to the whole either you strike out, you pop out, or you hit a home run, and you're not trying to spray the ball around the field because they're not focusing on putting the it's why waste time with a guy like Ortiz trying to teach him to hit the other way. You know, he's not Wade Boggs. They're not asking him to be Wade Boggs.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like that the game is headed that direction, that it's all or nothing. And basically everybody's trying to become a 3 true outcome hitter, strikeout, walker, home run. I mean, it leads to things that I'm going to touch. It leads to games like the Orioles Red Sox game today, where the Orioles struck out 13 times, or it leads to, the Oriole Yankee game yesterday, where the Orioles won the game 4-3 in the 11th. But the Yankees out-hit the Orioles, 14-4 or something like that?
That line was embarrassing. They went, I know at one point it was 3-3-0 and 3-13-1, I believe, going into the 10th.
Yeah. So, like, I'm a fan of the manufactured run. I'm a fan of the guy that can hit to all fields, that keeps the defense honest. So basically I'm just going to keep saying that I'm a fan of Mike Trout because that's what he does. And as long as guys are going to keep getting paid for being 30, 40, 50 home run guys, they're going to be
right,
doing whatever it takes to hit the ball out of the ballpark. And that's going to be launch angle and exit velocity. And that's going to, like, nobody can go the other way. And it's a shame. It really is. But,
you know, it makes me wonder. I had heard often that if he really wanted to, Ichiro could have been a very good power hitter. But he almost did he was so talented, though. I mean, the guy was inhuman. He would be able to take a ball anywhere in the zone and hit it on the screws and just hit it right over the infielders in front of the outfielders, which that's ideal. That's what you're asking for. But there's just so few of those guys these days. You know, I think the idea of small ball, like you said, and moving a runner over is getting somewhat lost. And I, in a way, makes me kind of like the runner on second rule in the extras. I don't like that it starts in the 10th. I think it should start at least one full rotation, one more full set of nine outs through the rotation or the lineup. But mm-hmm. I think when, as I've seen in all these games, once there's a runner on second, you know, if you're a Yankee fan, you're going to see a guy like Judge get up and you're thinking, all right, here we go. Sweet. 2-run advantage. Kill it. same thing with Stan. You saw that grand slam earlier in the week. I mean, that thing was a moonshot. You're thinking, all right, this is easy two-run lead. But then you have a guy like, hypothetically, DJ LeMahieu come up, and you think, all right, well, we're going to get at least a run out of this, and then hopefully bring on a closer. Now, I understand most teams do not have a lockdown closer, and in my head, I still think, you know, Mariano Rivera is going to come out of there and just, you know, we can go home early. But you would never do that. You got to wait till New York, New York. But anyway.
Chapman throws slouch, even if he's not exactly the world's poster child for how to act as a human being.
Absolutely not. But, you know, when you look at the way these late games are constructed with these larger bullpens, I think it really is making most of the teams in the league, like I would, if I'm an Orioles fan, you're not going to have too many guys that you come up, I can't imagine, and say, all right, sweet, here's our two-run lead. You're thinking, okay, you bump the guy over, no problem. You just do that. It's a no-brainer. Get him on third, and then you have one shot to get a long fly to bring him in. And if it goes out, there's your two runs. But if it goes, at least you're putting pressure on the other team. And no matter what, even if you hear a crack of the bat, you know, unless it's a dribbler to third, there's always that chance that the guy on second is going to make it to third. And if there's a bobble in the outfield or a bad throw home or a bad throw to the infield, that's the game. If there's an error with a guy on second, I'm telling you, that's going to cost a lot of teams a lot of games this season. We haven't really – I don't think we've seen it happen terribly much yet, but it will certainly be a problem for teams that cannot defend well when one error in the late innings or in the extra innings, that'll be the game.
Yeah. Unless you have a guy that can put a ball on the line so that G.R. Urshela can catch a face full of leather.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Had to get the big in. Just had to do it.
But you know, you look at these lineups, and I know some of these players they're trying to hit these long balls, the ones especially who are making the big money, and I think of them kind of in the almost the Albert Pujols mold. You know, you're just big, strong guys. You know, going back to even McGuire, I for the sake of this conversation. You know, he was just a big guy, and I understand that there were PEDs and steroids. But, you know, a lot of these players claim that the PEDs and steroids are mostly used to recover. And I don't doubt that. I think a guy like Andy Pettitte truly used it to recover. He wasn't – I just believe some of these guys actually had the integrity. But when you look at the way they're built and the way they play the game and the torque on their body – I just don't see a guy like, say, Aaron Judge really panning out for the long term. I mean, he's 28. He'll be 29 next year, if I'm not mistaken. I might be off by a year, but he's up there going into his first free agency because he went to college. But the guy can't play more than six games without, you know, initially they had said, oh, we're just going to sit him because it was his rest day. First off, that's something else. And I understand it. I mean, I get it. It's not where, you know, the Cal Ripken days, they're done. It's not happening. The days of a guy playing a full 162, it would be irresponsible to do that at this point. You know, I forget off the top of my head the pitcher who threw the no-hitter that had 140-ish pitches or something like that. Those days are done because they're trying to keep these big, strong guys in these little compact windows of time where they can hit the home run or make the big play. But if you keep sending them out there, they're going to break. And I think all of this leads me to think, you know, why not build a cheaper team with all contact hitters and just have them just keep moving guys from first to second to third? You're never going to be out of it. And when it comes to those extra innings, you're always going to be able to get that guy in from second. I mean, how do you feel about the construction of baseball teams that seem to always be leaning towards those power hitters and then giving them all the money? I mean, I take that into account.
Well, yeah, I think you kind of hit on it. Why part of the reason why the starting pitcher that routinely goes out and throws 7, 8, 9 innings, the reason that's not going to happen anymore is because they're too valuable I need you, like, I'd rather have you go out and give me six innings of shutdown, and then I can turn to the guy that throws 100 out of the bullpen to get me the last couple outs, and then I can do this again in 5 days instead of, and I can do that every week to get me through a 162-game season, as opposed to, hey, I can run you out there. I know you're going to go nine innings and finish the game, but I'm going to be missing you for the last month of the season because you threw your arm out. So, like, they're like, the players are just too valuable, and that goes for the hitters too, the Aaron Judges and everything. Like, you know, we, you want to talk about, like, is the rest worth it, even though it's this early in the season? Like, yeah, okay, so could they have used his bat, say, could they have used his bat yesterday in that game against the Orioles? Sure, it's another big imposing guy, right, that you make one mistake, this game is over, but it's also one game, and I don't think the Yankees are in any danger of, you know, winning or losing the AL East by one game when it's all said and done. Now, maybe they
I disagree on that.
Playoff.
Just to be fair, I have to give Tampa Bay their respect. I think they always show up at the end of the season and force the Yankees to play guys when they don't want to, and they're not conditioned to do that. But keep going.
Well, and that spins into where you were going with roster construction. And, that, you know, if you want a, you want an exact portrait of what you were talking about, the lineup of nine guys who are just going to hit the ball and they're not going to try and knock it all over the place, and we're just going to go for the cheap cheap put-the-ball-in-play guys, that's Tampa. And that's what Oakland was under Billy Oakland back in the 90s.
The Moneyball team.
When the Moneyball era started, because you can't afford to pay the home run hitters, because every 30, 40 home run guy is now a 6-7, or, you know, in the case of Fernando Tatis and I'm blanking on the name, the Mets, Lindor, you know, the Tatis and Lindor guys, with these contracts, you can't afford to pay a 30, 40 home run guy. So, you know, you get, sometimes if you're not a major market like a New York or an LA, you have to do that. And I do think we're at the beginning of seeing more franchises moving that way. I think the Yankees are always going to be constructed as the Bronx Bombers, just because they can be. They're always going to have the money. They're always going to be able to, you know, buy everybody's 40, 50 home run prospects. Same thing with the Dodgers. The Cubs,
and you'll see that
a
with the Mets
situation.
Coming
up. Yeah. Yeah, I think the Mets are going to be in a similar situation, assuming that, you know, they don't run into some other silly things. But, like, I look at what the Orioles are doing with Mike Elias, and I love where we're headed. They're heading in the direction of the Tampa Bay Rays. They're heading in the direction of the Houston Astros, where let's get this system built and then just keep that system
trade them all away.
Stocked and hey, you know what? Trade them away and get more guys in here. I don't care. The classic Seinfeld reference, you know, at the end of the day, you're rooting for laundry. It's what it is. Like, the, at
so
the end of the
what
day,
do you want,
you're
though?
Rooting
out
for,
of,
you're rooting for your team.
You're seeing. You know, you seem very pleased with the direction of the Orioles. So, you know, they're not gonna. I personally don't believe that they will be able to. They're not going to win this year. You know, let's be fair. I don't see it happening next year. Although, again, we have seen teams like the Pirates and the Nationals and the Royals even in the last 10, 15 years kind of have these flashes where they really just show up. You know, they're your small market teams.
Orioles,
I think the Twins
the
are.
Orioles were that.
Orioles yeah, was it
2015, 2016?
2016. Yeah, that little era there.
2016, yeah, in that era.
So are you, you know, chasing that feeling again that, all right, we're building to a 3 to 4 year stretch where we can really compete and day in and day out go up against any team, and we understand that we're going to get outslugged, but while you're punching us in the face, we're slowly chopping away at your legs? I mean, is that your goal as a fan?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think this 2021 season to me kind of feels a little bit like 2011, maybe 2010, more than 2011, where you're coming in, you get off to a nice start, you you know, you punch a couple people in the mouth early, put a scare in, make them realize, you know, hey, you can't just show up and beat us. The Orioles are going to take the field. They're going to make you earn the win. You're going to win, but you're going to have to fight to get this. You're going to have to fight to get 2 out of 3, and you know the Orioles will get their 30% out of that. And they're just kind of, they look like they're moving in the right direction. I think 2023 is probably the target year, the way that I'm looking at it, with the guys that they have in the AA, AAA level that are set to come up, which creates an interesting approach to some of the guys that they have up here now, like John Means, Anthony Santander, Trey Mancini. Those guys are going to kind of be coming towards the end of their club control period, right about the time that you're hoping the guys at the top of the minor league system are ready to translate into major league talent. So that'll be interesting to see what they do. Do you trade them this year? Do you hold them for another year? Like, where are we at there? But I think there's a lot of reason to be hopeful that, and it's not so much the on-field results as, or in terms of the win-loss column, but it's going to be, are these prospects making progress? And it's really going to be some of the young pitchers that are going to come up throughout the season.
So
Gene
really,
Kramer,
really,
Keegan Aiken, those kind of guys.
Really, in a way, you're just saying, is it trending in the right direction? And you hope that it is, as opposed
right.
to, you know, again, I'm a Jets fan. Adam Gase did not do that. So,
right.
You know, I try to bring in my Jet fandom sometime to almost counter my Yankee fandom. So, like, I, you know, as much as you want to feel free to get on me for being a Yankee fan, I'll just remind you that I'm a Jet fan, and I do understand what pain is like.
And you and I will just trade on that because I'm a Steeler fan and an Oriole fan. So, you know, I get the good football, the crap baseball. You get the good baseball, the crap football. So it's fine.
Oh, boy. I can't win. But, you know, if you look at the guys that you're mentioning, especially I'm thinking about, like, the Trey Mancinis, you know, you're going to have to either pay a guy in your team or, and I just think there's something to bringing in an outside guy that you're just going to have to pay. And I know Chris Davis has just left an absolutely awful taste in your mouth from that deal that, you know, I hate to say it, will be brought up a lot, you know, will be Bobby Bonilla like in the long term. But you're going to have to bring in some outside help. I thought what the Padres have done, honestly, if I'm a small market team, and I don't know where I'd put the Padres in terms of the market, but they're moving their way up. And making themselves an established brand. You know, that's a word I really should be
yep.
using here, is in addition to just being the makeup of the franchise, you're building your brand to have players come over. Now, Nate, I'm a lifelong Nets fan. I actually am a lifelong Nets fan. I grew up in New Jersey, and my dad is from Boston. So, like a great kid, I decided to pick every team against his. And I saw a team like the Nets go from, you know, they were title contenders in the early 2000s. They had a couple flashes of greatness with, you know, Jason Kidd. You know, Brook Lopez was a great player. And you talk about your, you know, that starting pitcher that you love. And it reminds me of
John
when,
Maine.
You know, we had a young John Maine. Thank you. And we had, you know, Brook Lopez as a Net fan. It's like, all right. We did it. We got our guy. We're going to build around this dude. Let's trade for a veteran. Let's go for it. And then they brought in the wrong guys. But they kept the culture. There was that winning sense of we're going to break through. And I think that's where the Nationals were when they were able to get Strasburg and Harper in back-to-back years, which was embarrassing. An embarrassment of riches. I cannot believe they didn't keep those two guys as a core, but that's a whole other conversation. I'll admit, Nate, I think the more I talk to you, the more I'll be focusing on a franchise like the Orioles. I think they've got, hopefully a lot of good young players in the pipeline, but I really hope that the Orioles bring somebody in at some point, and find a way to even, you know, I've always thought about a guy like an Albert Pujols type, maybe not him specifically, but that type, an older guy who can come in and bring some stability to the lineup, and also some version of experience from outside the franchise.
I expect that they will, because, and the reason why I say that is you look at 2014, that's what they did. Like that Orioles team that was really good from 2012 to 2016, where I think, I'm pretty sure in that stretch, they were the winningest team in the American League. Now they have nothing to show for it aside from one division crown, and they got to the ALCS once in that span, but they were a really, really strong ball club.
Wow, I forgot they won 96 games that year.
Yeah. In that stretch, you know, you had guys that all came up. Now, they weren't all draft picks, but they all came up through the system, like Chris Tillman, Zach Britton. Brian Mattis was kind of the joke of the bullpen, but he served his role because he basically came in to get Mark Teixeira and David Ortiz out, and he did that every time. He couldn't get anybody else in Major League Baseball out, but he could get those two guys out. So when you're playing them 19 times a year, it's useful. You had a bullpen with Darren O'Day. Go ahead.
No, you know, I got to be honest with you. You're reeling these off of memory, but I admit I don't remember that team terribly much. But I'm looking at it. I'm like, yeah, I mean, you had, you know, Manny Machado was 21 on that team. You had J.J. Hart. But see, I'm talking about the older guys. I think Nelson Cruz is the perfect example. He was 33, had a lot of experience at that point, was a solid hitter. He was your DH, and that's I think the guy I'm hoping that the Orioles can find mesh with another group of young players.
He's exactly what you're talking about, and they've shown that they are willing to do that when they get to that point. Nelson Cruz came in, and you talk to Oriole fans, the biggest mistakes that Dan Duquette and the Angelos family made in that run was not re-signing Nelson Cruz, was not re-signing Nick Markakis, and probably not re-signing Andrew Miller, because they traded Eduardo Rodriguez to the Red Sox, and Rodriguez went out and beat him today
right, to
get Andrew Miller. And, you know, you can talk to some Oriole fans today, and they look at that like, oh, what a garbage trade. We didn't win the World Series with Andrew Miller, and we didn't need him to get to the ALCS. Well, they're wrong, because without Andrew Miller in our bullpen, he ends up in the Tigers' bullpen, who we face in the ALDS. And if Andrew Miller's in the other dugout, I don't think the Orioles win that ALDS. They don't even go to the ALCS against the Royals.
No, Nate, I got to stop you here real quick. I think I have a caller on the line that I want to bring in.
Okay. I also see that we're getting out of time. But...
yeah, we are. But I want to get this guy in. How you doing?
Hello?
Hello. You're on.
Hi, this is Art Vandelay. And I just wanted to say I'm enjoying this, and I appreciate you doing the SOR best hit, talking about Cruz and Markakis not being re-signed.
Art Vandelay.
This is fantastic. And I'm enjoying the heck out of this. And you can thank Pat for telling us to call in. So this is fantastic, and I'm loving every second of it.
Thank you very much. So, Dave, just to give you a little background, there's an Orioles, the local cable channel that carries the Orioles game, has an online blog that I like to go in and I chat about, you know, pregame, postgame, you know, during the day when you get bored. And Art Vandelay is one of the regular posters that I chat with. And before we came on air today, I reminded them that we were going to be doing this. So I'm really glad to hear that other people are out there listening to this.
That is great. Love it. And, you know, I got to say, Art Vandelay, which, by the way, I love the Seinfeld reference. I have to say, you guys are turning me into a little bit of a closet Orioles fan when they're not playing the Yankees, of course. But guys, I really appreciate it. Nate, I know you had brought up one little piece of trivia that you wanted to bring up. Can you close the show with the trivia? You got a minute.
Sure. We could do it as a factoid, but I'm going to do it as a trivia so that we can drive people to the Sports City Chef blog and read the content that's going there. So we'll post the answer next week on Wednesday. today the Orioles set a little bit of infamous history. So all of the SOR people that are listening, they already know this answer. The Orioles set a piece of infamous MLB history for consecutive games with a, for five consecutive games with a number of strikeouts. How many times have the Orioles struck out in the last five games?
All right, guys, head to the blog to find out. Thank you for tuning in. We'll catch you next time, same place.
Sports City, Sports City, Chefs, Chefs, Sports City, Sports City, Chefs, Chefs, Sports City, Sports City, Chefs, Chefs, Sports City, Sports City, Chefs, kaboom, Sports City Chefs is in the room, cooking up hot topics to put up on your spoon, they well in tune, blown like a flower in June, Superman verse MF Doom, the clouds loom, so tell a friend it's the Sports City Chefs again. Pay attention, tune in, we on the set again. Sports City, Chef, Chef. Sports City, Chef, Chef. Yeah. Cabbie. Todd.
Woo! Connecticut.